Thursday, January 12, 2012. The radio program is on the air. The nation's most listened to sports talk presentation on the Fan Radio Network, Sirius and Sportsnet. It's Primetime Sports. Bob McCown, Damien Cox. In our Toronto studios, a little bit later on, John Paul Morosi, Fox Sports baseball analyst. The Reverend Andrew Sheldon is a professor at the University of Toronto. He'll join us in studio. He believes, the Reverend, the good Reverend, believes that Tim Tebow's words and actions suggesting God has an opinion is problematic. Who am I to argue with that? We're going to address that a little bit later on as well. For those of you who have been listening, and we apologize to those who live in markets who are now just joining the program, call your local station and have them explain to you why they don't carry the last hour. Alex Anthopoulos was in here for a good 40 minutes, and we went on and on and on about a variety of things. And here's, in a nutshell, here's what I believe. The Blue Jays bid on Yu Darvish, but bid something tangibly less.
30.
I was going to say between 25 and 30. Under the premise that if it was going to take 50, they weren't going to go to that.
Which would then make you wonder, then why bid at all?
Well, because in case nobody does bid 50.
I think that sounds right. He won't say it, though. We tried.
No.
Over and over. Now we got to try with Healy.
So now the thing is, Texas apparently is reasonably close to doing a deal with Darvish. And the numbers that are out there, 5 years, $65 million.
Which means your overall acquisition cost for this player, well, it's going to be $116
million over 5 years.
That's an expensive starter.
$23 million a year for a guy with no major league experience.
Better love him.
It would be like giving my replacement whenever that time comes, $23 million a year with no experience.
Hearing footsteps?
I'm making footsteps. Oh, look at the cat dragged in here from the pages of CBC's Hockey Night in Canada. Do they even have pages over there?
No, they don't, Bob.
Glenn Healy. I'll bet they have pages. Are there pages at CBC?
No, but it just in, just came across the wire.
Yes.
Ajax Pickering News Advertiser, most overrated broadcaster, Damien Cox.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's
number
2 years in a row, Heels.
Oh, no.
2 years in a row for me.
Do you think if Burke was here tonight, he'd defend you like he did Dion?
No. Not a chance.
It's like the OJ trial, that. You tried to get to him.
So Berkey's in here last night. He defends Dion. Well, he defends Komisarek, too. And of course, he threw some names out at people, which is what he does. And I would expect him to defend his own player.
Hey, you would have been surprised. I agree.
if he slagged the hell out of him, of course I'd be surprised. But Healy has no such mandate. Would Dion Phaneuf be on your top 10 list of most overrated players?
No, I think that list is a joke. First off, I can't believe the players did it. Right? That's like saying, okay, we're gonna do the dumbest players in the league. Okay, sure. Let me just write down 10 names. Like a Ginla, for instance. I mean, he's got how many gold medals in the Olympics? 2. A Rocket Richard, a King Clancy, an Art Ross, a Lester B. Pearson. That's not good enough. That's overrated. You know, Luongo, as much as we don't like his finals last year, the guy did win the Jennings. He did win a gold. And he's played 700 games. 701 games, in fact. Pretty good career. Pronger's been around for a couple decades. Couple golds, Stanley Cup. I mean, those are Hall of Fame numbers for some of these guys.
And the weird thing is, Glenn, who's overrating Dion Phaneuf? Who's running around saying this is the greatest defenseman ever? Who's running around saying he should win the Norris Trophy or he's better than Zdeno Chara, he's better than Nick Lidstrom? Nobody is.
No, one goalie has played more than Luongo who could vote on him. And that's Brodeur. Name the other players that have more than 500 goals to say, that guy's way overrated. But, you know, I do get it. Like, Dion, from ice level, when I do games, he is one picked-on player.
In what way?
Just the trash talk that goes on, and whether it's Dion's intensity, whether it's the fact that, you know, when he came out of the World Juniors, you know, TSN made him a hero and a god, and then he went to Calgary. He did get traded for 25% of the Leaf team, though, at one point. granted, they were a 29th place team, but you got traded for a good chunk of the team. But I, you know, for whatever reason, there's certain players that just aren't liked, and maybe he's one of them. But to be ninth in scoring and defense, and you know, the list to me just reeks of players looked at the salary and went, oh, he's making that, he's overrated.
Right.
Well, they
don't
I think
look
you
at the full body of work.
Right. Inadvertently or otherwise, I think you were right at the top of what you said, and that is the only thing that this survey demonstrates is that there are 116 really stupid guys in the NHL who would take part in this thing. Because
yeah.
I think you've got to be really stupid to say, yes, I will do this. Don't you?
I certainly wouldn't be advocating it because you know...
There's no upside to this.
No, and you know, to make the NHL, you're you know, one of... I don't even know what the odds are, but just to play a game in the NHL is near impossible. There are only 5,000 players that have ever played one game in the National Hockey League ever in the history of our game, and there are about 2,500 that are alive. We could put them all in your station. And so it's a small little hockey community, and to me, there's no benefit to this. It's just embarrassing players and downside.
Well,
it's like the draft last year when you know a player's going to get picked last.
Right.
And you let it happen. Like, come on, are you kidding?
Mm.
And then you got another guy up there taking pictures of him. Go, this would be an embarrassing moment. I can tweet this.
Well, if they asked a bunch of players who the best player is, or maybe most underrated player.
Why didn't
player,
they ask them a number of things?
Well, they do that with the left, with what's now the Ted Lindsay Award, right? They ask them who's the best player in our game.
Well, that makes sense. Those kinds of questions where you're eliciting a positive response.
I disagree with both of you on this.
You do.
I have no problem with these players answering the question. I think it could be an interesting question. I think they all got the question wrong. I think what they answered was who they think is the most overpaid player in the league, not who the most overrated player is. Their answers make no sense. I mean, you cannot like Dion Phaneuf if he wants.
What's the difference, though?
Well, the difference is a guy who isn't able to do what people think he can do. And you can look at Dion Phaneuf and not be
overrated?
Yeah. So you can look at Dion Phaneuf and say, I don't like this or that about him. But A, I don't know who's saying he's a great player. And B, they've got the third or fourth best power play in the league. Well, he's running it. He plays 26 minutes a night.
Yeah.
They're a decent team in a playoff position. How can he be?
I can't presume to.
Does he make too much? Maybe.
I have no idea how the question was worded or what the guys thought about it. My sense is simply that I think the two questions are principally the same. If they asked me who the most overrated was, I would start with, okay, give me a list of salaries. See, it wouldn't be about public opinion or about who talks about who in the dressing room. It would be about salary.
And the players that do vote on it have nothing but free time to vote on it. Because I can tell you dressing rooms that I've been in, whether it's Mark Messier as the leader or Matt Sundin, he barely had time to read the name on my back of my sweater, let alone, let's do a survey. Not a chance. So it's the guys with the lots of time and Twitter accounts that decided that they're going to weigh in and embarrass some players. I think it stinks.
All right, let's move on. I want to ask you about Mike Camilleri and what he had. He said before, Bob and I were talking about this already, stats say fighting is down 25% in the NHL this year.
Or more.
Why?
Depending on who you believe.
Why is it down?
Well, the role of the, you know, prototypical tough guy is gone away like the dodo bird. They just don't have a guy that you can just sit and play.
In 4 months, Heels?
I have no doubt that changes in the game, speed in the game, as teams craft their team to win, that isn't one of the recipes for winning. It may have been in 2004 when, you know, Anaheim had two of them in their lineup. They had Peros and they had Brad May. But today's game, you just don't have a space for that kind of player. You're better suited to have a penalty killer on that fourth line. You're better suited to have a fourth line center iceman like Manny Malhotra to take important draws. It's a valuable spot. It might be, yeah, okay, we got 18 skaters. Do we really need 18? Yeah, you need more than 18. You probably need 12 defensemen to get to the finals, and you need at least that up front. And the stage fighting days are over. And if they do have stage fights, do we even get to see them? They happen in a corner behind the play. We don't even get to watch them. We're like, oh, there's a couple guys fighting. What happened? Nothing. They're going to go sit in the box, and that's their last shift.
Yeah.
You know, the guys that matter are guys like Thornton in Boston, you know, where he plays. He plays 9 minutes a night and contributes. And when they put him into the series again in the finals in Game 3, he made a difference.
Yeah, he did.
Those are difference makers. But in a huge way, that guy who just goes out and beats up the other knucklehead, and then they chirp at each other from the penalty box, and they do it again the next time they play, it's gone.
With Glenn Healy of Hockey in Canada and CBC. Camilleri, is he looking for an exit visa, or is he a concerned member of the Montreal Canadiens who felt the need to voice an opinion?
Well, as I see this unfolding, and anyone who's been to Montreal, the media circus there is almost laughable. There are more talk shows. There are more, in both languages, by the way.
Yes.
You have to have it in both. But it's sensationalized, and they pick apart every little bit of that team and who's going out the night before and who was out the night after and who's got a girlfriend. And it's almost laughable. Now, for the way I see this going down is Mike's numbers are down since Cunningworth's taken over. Cunningworth's going to put his stamp on the team. I've seen him do it with P.K. Subban when he sat him out. And so he's a frustrated player. I don't think the comments were made at the podium in front of a large scrum of media in a general sense saying, our team stinks because we don't compete. And, you know, we're just not trying, and we're losers. No. I think the comments were made in general by Mike about the state of teams that win and the state of teams that don't win. And he made it in a private moment, more or less, to one of these guys who's on one of these shows, and boom goes the dynamite. This guy says, I got myself a story, and I can run with this for a month. And that's what it's going to be. But that's, I think, more the gist of how this went down and the spirit of what Mike was saying. Because he certainly isn't a selfish guy. He certainly isn't a bad guy. And he certainly cares. And I can go down the list in that team and find you a couple that don't.
Sportsnet magazine this month is running a piece, a front page piece, saying Montreal Canadiens over 30 years have declined into nothing but a shell of what they were 30 years ago. Do you believe that? And do you believe this franchise, as it stands today, is in real trouble?
No. Again, sensationalistic journalism. I mean, the Montreal Canadiens at one point in their organization's life got every French-born player that there was in the province. And when there was a whisper that they couldn't get one, like Jean Béliveau, they just went and bought the league and got him. Simple as that. Right? An unfair playing advantage if you're with the California Golden Seals or you're some other team. They are a club that I think has reinvented themselves since Gillette bought them. And it's more like a soccer-like atmosphere in that building. I think the president, Boivin, has done a really good job of bringing a young crowd into the game. And Damien, you'd know, it's borderline dangerous when you leave here at night, isn't it? Like, you're worried as you're walking to your hotel across the street because it's madness on the streets. And if it's a playoff game, it's lunacy. Yet, there certainly is a decline this year. They haven't had a cup since 93, but we don't have a picture in color yet of the Stanley Cup. It's a little bit different, and they need to rebuild. They've made some bad trades, but they have a strong fan base, and this is a storied organization. I don't buy it.
Would you fire the GM?
Yes.
Would you fire the GM now?
Yes.
I made this point earlier with Michael Boone of the Montreal Gazette and suggested to him that the logical time for an organization to fire their GM is after the season ends, and I say the logical time for the Montreal Canadiens to fire their GM is right now and find a new guy and bring him in and let him execute a more important part of the year, which is the trade deadline, rather than just the draft, which, for the most part, almost any monkey can do.
Well, I think Bob Gainey, to me, who has now recharged his batteries, was burnt out after the 100th anniversary and all the stuff that goes along.
You'd bring him back?
I would bring him back, and I would at least get him to stabilize the franchise. You're bang on, Bobcat. You've got to go through, you know, this big period where you have a chance at the trade deadline. You're going to have a draft, which is certainly an important part of rebuilding an organization, and you're going to have a free agency period before we even get to a deadline for collective bargaining. Cap is more than likely going to go up next year to probably $68-plus million because of the growth, because you know that's what it's going to be with revenues. And so you're going to have to spend your money July 1, and if you're going to let this guy spend your money July 1, then just wait to see the product you get in September. And his moves to me, or non-moves, have showed me he can't. The Markov signing's questionable. You know, some of their defense, there has to be a height limit for these guys to get on the ride, isn't there? And it's difficult at times to watch, but players that I clearly see that don't care, he keeps around. And maybe it's he can't trade them, but he's not putting his stamp on this franchise. And if I'm a fan, I'm impatient.
Mr. Molson is said to be talking to Serge Savard.
Well, certainly it would be better than looking at Gauthier, because he hasn't talked to anybody.
But Savard hasn't been there for 20 years.
There's no question that you probably have better candidates, but you bring something like that into that organization and you re-energize the fan base.
But you'd bring Ganey back.
The decisions or not, that depends on the group.
I disagree with both of you. I mean, if you're talking about, you're not advocating Savard.
No. I just said they're talking to him.
State the case where a guy has come back and been successful after going away.
Cliff wasn't really, was he?
It doesn't happen. You got to move forward, not backwards.
Well, there are some real bright assistant GMs that are around the league. The problem is you can't get those guys middle of the season. Right before the draft, you're just going to pluck them out of their contracts. It's difficult. I mean,
that's why you wait. You got to wait till the end of the year,
well,
and then you hire somebody in June.
Yeah, but Burke was here. Do you think, because there's
seven assistant GMs.
Yes, that's right. There's one on his roster that they are
interested in.
He's
not going anywhere.
Not the number two.
They've done what they did to Jimmy Neal, and that's pay that asset to stay.
Yep.
But
Dave
Nolan
is going nowhere.
Nashville's got a real bright guy in Paul Fenton. Yep. That club has no money, never has had money. They always makes trade to dump salary because the owner has no money.
Can't do it, though, Heels.
Well,
unless Paul has an ability to speak French that I'm not aware of.
There's that two-month course that he can get on, and I'll buy him the Rosetta Stone. But he's bright enough to rebuild that franchise. He's a young, up-and-coming star that will be a GM soon.
Let me ask you this. We haven't had Jan, I don't think, right, since last week's the NHLPA gutting the realignment plan. What'd you make of all that?
Well, it's 6 months out of collective bargaining, and I think the Players Association had certain demands and questions that they wanted answered, and I don't think the league was, one, willing to answer them. Number two, some of the questions they couldn't answer with regards to building availability. And so rather than the league give in to the players somewhat concessions as to how the schedule would be, how many days off there would be, what the travel would be, they just chose not to go down that road. And likewise, the Players Association, it is particularly in baseball, collective bargaining dictates a lot of where these teams play and what conferences they're in. And so 6 months out, this is just the start. And I would imagine that it's only going to get more contentious as we move along. Players that say that this is unrelated to labor, in my mind, no one can convince me that it is not. It is related to labor. And if they can't decide on conferences and scheduling and having teams be in a better place to make more revenue, then good luck with the other 10 items that are of far more importance.
The St. Louis Blues are on economic life support. The National Hockey League is inserting money into that equation to keep them from expiring. How many teams can the NHL own and operate simultaneously?
Wow. This is a tough one in the sense that it's been such a brilliant year in St. Louis. I mean, they've lost three games at home.
Hitch has done an unbelievable job, hasn't he?
So when it's one thing when you're a team like Columbus or you're a team like the Islanders, and you
right.
don't win. It's easy not to come, but they've got the product on the ice, and they just, again, the cap out of the lockout was $39 million. Clubs could handle that for the most part. Now you're into $64, $65, $30 million to run your club. It means you got to make $95 before you make a penny. It's tough sledding. And when you go down the Rolodex and you can't find owners that want to buy these teams, you get a pretty good idea that Gary's going to redo the business model, because it's very difficult to succeed if you have to pay out that kind of money and you just can't generate the revenue.
As I was, you answered my question, I think, because I was going to say to you, if you were going to buy the St. Louis Blues, would you keep them in St. Louis?
No.
The correct answer is no.
There's a nice little landing spot just north of here by a GO train station someone's
really?
Going to build a rink on.
You're telling me after 40 years in St. Louis, you're ready to pull the plug on St. Louis?
Well, we'll go
there's
there.
No there there.
We'll go there on vacation, but I think I can make more money in New York region.
There's no there there, Damien.
Yeah, but it's not just,
How do you economically turn it around?
Well, the Blues have had success. The problem for the Blues is that it's been so erratic there, and ownership has been so erratic there.
But as Heel says, they've won like a million in a row since Hitch got there.
Yeah, but you cannot evaluate the St. Louis Blues as an organization based on a 14 game or 20 game or 25 game.
As a fan,
Ken Hitchcock.
No, as a fan, you can.
If you historically looked at coming out of the lockout, which teams have made money and which teams haven't made money. And that is not just a snapshot of a 14-game skid. This is years of work for that club. They probably have not made money in any of the years coming out of the lockout, and in some of the years have lost north of $10 million.
Yeah, but, I mean, Heels, the Washington Capitals don't make money. You know, there's a lot of teams that don't make money in the NHL.
21 out of 30 teams are underwater.
I hear what you're saying. But to me, the St. Louis Blues are a totally different animal that you're talking about moving than the Phoenix Coyotes or the Nashville Predators or the Florida Panthers. The St. Louis Blues, I acknowledge they've not been successful. And maybe it's just the Minnesota North Stars. The
I understand
same thing
what you're
they
saying.
Were. But the St. Louis Blues.
I understand what you're saying. But the problem is.
That has been a good market at times.
But what I asked Heels was, if you bought them, would you keep them there? Meaning, do you think you can turn the economics
around? That's
because
he thinks he can put a team in York Region. That's
I'm a greedy Scottish guy. I'm looking to take the team and go to an ideal spot. But Damien's right. I mean, the team has
he
great,
is not.
He, yes, the team has great, great history. And if you're looking again, a cap out of the lockout of $39 million and revenue sharing of $13 million, okay, if you're good, the PA would say, let's take that revenue share and we're going way north of that, $24, $25 million, then they've got a chance. But, of course, Gary will come back and say, no, player cost are your problem. That's what we got to take care of. So let's ask for 20-some percent back and then roll these salaries back. And that's where the both sides, the fix for the problem is polar opposite.
The solution is as clear as the nose on your face. 22 franchises in Southern Ontario. And now you have a league.
That might be a bit of a stretch.
Glenn Healy of Hockey Night in Canada. When we come back, John Paul Morosi of Fox Sports. Bud Light gets a contract extension. One of these is going to be a contract for life if he keeps getting more and more of these. They're running out of time for contract extensions. We'll talk about it when Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network Sirius and Sportsnet. Yards. Primetime, the nation's most listened to sports talk presentation on the Fan Radio Network on Sirius Channel 157 around the world and up your feet. And if you don't like radio, we are on TV too. On Sportsnet in high definition, Bob McCown, Damian Cox. The Reverend Andrew Sheldon will join us in studio. He's going to explain why the team, Tim Tebow pisses him off.
I don't think he'll say it that way.
What it looks like.
I think he'll use more sophisticated language.
Well, he doesn't like.
And I'd like to think that you will use more sophisticated language as well.
With the Reverend?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I'm going to clean up my act entirely.
All right.
I'll be a very good boy.
I doubt that.
Because you never know when the ground starts to shake.
You want to have the right guys on your side.
When that day comes, I'll be looking up. Bud Selig gets a contract extension. Is this the last contract extension? Is his last contract going to expire with him? Is he commissioner for life? And is this a good idea? John Paul Morosi is a baseball analyst for Fox Sports and joins us. How you doing?
Very good, guys. How are you?
We're all right.
All right. Well, I tell you what. At the World Series, he was talking about how he was joking with the reporters about, well, my wife never really believes when I talk about retirement. And sure enough, here we are, 2-year extension. But there it is, the third paragraph of the release from Major League Baseball, a quote from Toronto's own Paul Beeston, quote, the great prosperity of the game today is a reflection of Bud's record of accomplishment.
That's Beeston just sucking up.
There you have it, though. He was, it sounds like at least he has Mr. Beeston's support. But no, I really think overall when you look at it, certainly there are some issues that maybe have not gone perfectly to plan in Bud Selig's reign as commissioner, but overall I think he's done a very good job, and I think that the growth of the game being where it is now, the revenues and everything else, revenue sharing, et cetera, I think that the owners certainly feel strongly about him because they're still making money for the most part, and that's why they wanted to bring him back.
Well, I mean, he's been on the job for 20 years, and another four and a bit, and he'll be the longest-serving commissioner in baseball history.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
It is pretty wild to think about that when, given the somewhat accidental nature of the way his tenure began, when basically Faye Vinson was voted out and they were scrambling for a leader, and there it was, Bud Selig. So I think that when you look at that dynamic, he's really had quite a bit of staying power for a former car salesman from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. When you think about his place in the game and his now place in baseball history, is pretty impressive.
Was he the only member of the club to wind up running the club? You know what I mean? A former owner, the first owner to take over as commissioner? No.
You're testing my historical knowledge going far back. Back before I was born, but I can't think of the most recent case where that would have been the instance.
Well,
so it really, as you pointed out, a very rare career trajectory to go from being an owner to then running the entire show, which he's actually done pretty well now for about two decades.
Yeah, but see, JP, that's my point in this, and this is my has always been my level of being uncomfortable with Bud Selig as commissioner. I feel like he wasn't. He was the search committee for himself that he probably lobbied. You know what I mean?
It's like the Dick Cheney complex, right? It's like you're running the search and you nominate yourself.
Well, it's right. Incestuous, I think, isn't it?
Well, and there was a time, guys, where he actually still had his stake in the Brewers.
Well,
so really,
yeah.
When you don't want to talk about conflicts of interest, that I think would be the defining measure of that. But I guess I'll say this about it. He enjoys such strong support from the owners because he allows them to keep making money. And when you think about it, the players must feel that way because they have now had basically, from the recent baseball history, an unprecedented run of labor peace. So clearly, the players are making money, the agents are making money, the executives are making money, the sponsors are making money. So when you really look at the big picture, but for a few clubs that are probably operating in the red for the most part, the game overall is pretty healthy. So I think that really this is almost just a vote for the status quo that, hey, we're not going to mess up a good thing. We're all getting paid here, so why is there a reason to change?
All right, but
Bud's feeling good. Sounds good, you know?
Sorry to jump in here, Damien, but let me. There's two things that I attach and will, I think, forever attach to the Bud Selig biography. Number one, in one of the most boneheaded moves of all time, he somehow decided that I can create interest in the All-Star game by getting the winner, letting the winner of that game have the extra home date in the World Series. I'm not even talking about the tie game. Forget that. That was a blip.
Yeah. Well,
so there's a dumb
one. I'm sure there's probably a lot of people in Texas that would be sympathetic to that argument, Bob, because by all rights, the Rangers probably should have had home field advantage in the World Series this past season.
Of course
they
should.
They'd probably be the world champions right now.
Of course they should. Here's number two. Bud Selig presided over the game during what might be considered its darkest period, that of performance-enhancing drugs. He was Nero. He stood around and fiddled while Rome burned.
He did. From that standpoint, now I will say this though: there are a lot of people that were associated with the game at that point in time that could have blown the whistle.
Oh,
and
you're
I
right.
Include the Players Association as well, and
then you
that
are correct.
Right to Donald Fear and the people there. So there were a lot of people I think complicit in it. A lot of people looked the other way. Media included, players, executives, scouts, everybody. So it's almost like everybody associated with that era kind of has that mark on them to a degree.
Yeah, but he was at the top of the food chain, JP.
He was, and ultimately the buck does stop with him. And one of those things now going forward, and of course we just recently talked about the Hall of Fame voting and where all that stands. Believe me, that's part of his legacy. And I actually think that one of the reasons why he's staying on for as long as he has is the longer he stays on, the less of a percentage the steroid stuff becomes. It's almost like a chemical mixture, so to speak. You keep adding more to the mixture, the bad stuff becomes less of a percentage. I think that's part of it. I think he wants to shepherd as well the Mets and Dodgers through through their tumultuous ownership times to the point that he can leave at the end of 2014 and say, hey, the Mets and Dodgers are back on solid footing. We've got all kinds of labor peace. We've distanced ourselves from the steroid era. We've gotten more stiffer penalties and testing and everything. I think he wants to be able to make that argument, and the further he gets away from the steroid era when he walks away, the easier it will be for him to make that case.
You mentioned the Baseball Hall of Fame this week. Barry Larkin has been inducted into the, or will be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame at Cooperstown on his own. We had an impassioned argument from the, what is he, the director, the president of the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame,
all right,
that Larry Walker has been unfairly ignored, that he only got 22% of the vote. And when you put his stats up against a lot of guys, he deserves it. A, what do you think of Larkin? B, what do you think of Larry Walker ever getting in?
Well, first of all, with Larkin, I think a very deserving candidate, and certainly in a year where I think a lot of baseball writers were at a loss and how they filled out their ballots. I am not yet a voter, but I know that there was a lot of uncertainty certainly surrounding guys like Bagwell, McGuire, any slugger that played in the steroid era, whether they've actually been proven guilty or not, carries a certain taint of suspicion. And I think that Larkin is one of these guys, he's never been linked to that stuff, so I think a lot of people felt very comfortable voting for him. I think that's one of the reasons why, frankly, Morris saw such a huge jump, is that they're like, okay, well, we can vote for Morris with a clear conscience, we can vote for Larkin with a clear conscience. It's one of the reasons why I think Lee Smith is continuing to climb. It's almost like the writers are punting that decision down the road a little bit. But in Larkin's case, a very deserving candidate. I think that, being here from Michigan, I've always kind of thought that he and Trammell are very similar players. Trammell's support is starting to pick up a little bit. I do always wonder, as a quick aside, if George Bell had not won the MVP in 87, Trammell might have a little stronger case. But be that as it may, Larry Walker, I think he's a guy that he's going to have to battle that perception of the Coors Field effect and from having the later years there. But obviously, when his years in Montreal, was a terrific player. I think that you're right. He may be just having to battle the perception, much like Trammell, of not having played in the big U.S. markets and somewhat suffering a bit of that, because really, when you look at his numbers, that was a terrific player with the batting titles and everything else he did. So he's a guy that may get some support as things go forward. But next year is a really interesting ballot because you got Bonds coming on, Clemens, BGO, a lot of big-name guys that we're going to have to start dealing with.
JP, you and Michiganders have to get over the George Bell thing. You understand?
You figured I had to slide that one in there, right?
You got to get over that, man. Move on.
George Bell was a great player. I just still think Trammell should have won.
Well, we understand that.
I think we got that.
We got to get out of here. Good to hear your voice. Thanks a lot, pal. We'll talk to you again.
Talking to you guys. We'll talk to you soon. You bet.
John Paul Morosi of Fox Sports. When we come back, the Reverend Andrew Sheldon in studio on Tim Tebow. His words, his actions. That's when Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network, Sirius, and Sportsnet. Fourteen before the hour, Bob McCowan, Damian Cox, in our Toronto studios. This may be the first time we've had a man of the cloth in the studio.
A man of the cloth.
Rough cloth.
I'm somewhat nervous. We've had a conversation with Andrew Sheldon, who's a professor at the University of Toronto and a priest in the Anglican Church. Priest?
Yes.
But very quickly, you've instructed us to call you Andrew so that my friends don't get mad at me if I say Andrew instead Absolutely. Of father or reverend.
I much prefer that.
Okay. Yes. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming
Good
in.
Good to see you. Thank you.
So what's your problem with Tim Tebow?
I'm not sure I have a problem with Tim Tebow necessarily. I don't know Tim Tebow, but I think the proposition that I'm suggesting is that the extent to which his behaviors, his actions, or his words suggest that God has an opinion about the result of an NFL football game is problematic.
Meaning Tim Tebow says thanks to God publicly, privately, and otherwise, mm-hmm. verbally and physically.
Yes.
And your inference there is that he somehow thinks that God's on his side but nobody else's.
I mean, I don't really know what he thinks. He may. But I think many people watching and listening get that message. And for instance, when he does say at the end of Sunday's game, I want to thank my Lord and Savior.
Jesus Christ.
He's just won a game. I want to thank him. One could infer that he's saying, thanks. Thanks for helping me win.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure there are ways in which Tebow's faith in God can help him win in this, to whatever extent it drives him or it gives him comfort. But the notion that God, as I said, intervenes to help out one team, one athlete over another is highly problematic because it really brings into question God's priorities, you know. Starving children, Denver Broncos, you know. Well, today we'll go with Denver, you know.
Yeah.
And so the priority question to me is a problem.
I mean, do you really think that's what he's saying? I mean, I think we all who have covered sports have become uncomfortable at different times at interviewing athletes, and you try to ask a question and you get the first of all, I'd like to, do, you know, yeah. And so they want, and so you get used to it a little bit.
Boxers are big with that. Have you ever noticed that?
Yeah. But in this case, simply saying if that's, isn't that what, particularly in the U.S., devout Christians who believe they are testifying to every day, to everybody they talk about, that's what they're doing. He's not saying, to me, when I hear that, I'm not hearing a guy saying, thanks for letting me win or thanks for letting us win. But beginning it, you could ask him, what'd you have for lunch? And he'd say, well, before I say that, I'd like to thank, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I hear what you're saying, but is that what you're really hearing, that he's saying?
No, as I said, I don't think I'm hearing him say that. I think it can be inferred by people, by others, by those who are listening and watching, and that could be worrisome. Because on the one hand, it could reinforce. You see, there are Christian people who believe that God intervenes on a regular basis in daily life. God reaches down and makes things happen or not happen.
You're not buying that.
No, because there are many other Christians that don't believe that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because for me, if I believe that God was doing that, intervening on a regular basis, I have some pretty serious questions about how God chooses to intervene or not. So I do think some Christians hear that, and they say, yes, Tebow's God's boy. You know, God's going to help him win. Especially in the face of that nasty Ben Roethlisberger, you know, who's clearly not God's boy. And as I said, what it can eventually do is make God look bad. I think there's a lot of reasonable people who will step back from
all of that. You think it sends the wrong message?
I think it could, that other types of Christians or people who are atheists could step back and say, yep, there they go again. They're attributing you know, intervention to God, and look how God's choosing to intervene.
Well, atheists or agnostics, if you will always take, generally speaking, mm-hmm. take that position of, oh, there he goes, you know, another Bible-thumping mm-hmm. guy, and I don't subscribe to that, and blah, blah, blah. So there's some negativity around that surrounding Tebow. Do mm-hmm. you think that Christians, God-fearing, believing people, are offended by what he does?
I believe there are some Christians who are offended really? By the thought that God would intervene in a football game. I would be one of those. Not offended with Tim Tebow necessarily, but with that notion that God would have a part. I think many Christians would be offended by that.
So where's the line, Andrew? What is it okay for Tim Tebow to say, and at what point are you offended or disagree?
It's perfectly fine for him to say, and as a Christian person, as a Christian leader, I might say anytime somebody in the public eye says, I am a faithful person, I'm a faithful Christian, I'm a faithful Jew, I'm a faithful Muslim, whatever,
right?
You know, I don't have a problem with that at all. It makes a difference in my life. I feel like I'm a better person because of it. That's fine. My concern is sort of tying it to performance, like performance enhancing faith. It's not that's the line for me. You know, that God is actually, I'm on my knees, that I've scored this touchdown because it is God that helped me to score this touchdown.
But let me, see, that's an interesting question.
We got a minute and a half. You got to be quick.
He is such a devout Christian. I think mm-hmm. he appears to be. We mm-hmm. don't know. He appears to be such. Wouldn't you also acknowledge, though, that his faith is clearly, appears to be driving his performance? His belief in what he believes is very much a part of what he's able to do.
I think for all of us at some level, our own sense of well-being, our own sense of ourselves, our own sense of our meaning, help us to perform better at whatever we do. And yes, sure, his Christian faith helps him to perform. I keep coming back to results. And the other thing is that Tim Tebow does not speak for all Christians, because my perspective is actually a Christian perspective as well. A discomfort with thinking that God intervenes in sports events. Many Christians would be uncomfortable with that.
I don't think he does say he speaks for all Christians. I don't think he has ever said that.
No, but I sometimes think that perhaps in the bigger picture, in the media perhaps, that's the voice that people will look at and say, that's, every Christian thinks that way.
Yeah. When I was 6 years old, we lost the finals in the little mite baseball thing, and I was sure that God intervened there, but you're pretty sure he didn't? Because we lost.
I don't know. The one exception to the rule.
I'm real happy with
the
him,
one exception to the rule might be when the Maple Leafs traded Frank Mahovlich. I pray that they would never win the Stanley Cup again.
I believe you are correct,
sir. As far as I'm concerned.
We have established the barometers. Thank you, Andrew. Andrew Sheldon, our thanks to John Paul Morosi, to Glenn Healy for joining us. Roundtable tomorrow. Good night from Toronto.